Clerk, session number 4799, room number 3.
Air Vice Marshal Long, Reel 3.
During my time at Farnborough, which was nearly 4 years, I took every opportunity of flying all the various types that were available in the several flights, the wireless flight and so on, at the RAE, and managed to get in a great number. Some of which, of course, was only one made, and so there was never another opportunity of flying that particular type. There was one aircraft, for example, called the Hawker Hornbill, and this was a single-seater fighter, and it had a 600-horsepower Rolls-Royce Condor engine. It was a most exciting, for those days, a most exciting aircraft to fly, and I did quite a lot of work on it for the aerodynamic flight and also for enjoying myself by doing aerobatics. Incidentally, during that time, there were aircraft which were very suitable for advanced aerobatics, and I taught myself as much as I possibly could about inverted flying and inverted spinning and so on. I should also mention that during my time at Farnborough, the parachute was introduced. Before that, nobody was using a parachute. The parachutes were produced, the seats were hollowed out so that you could sit on the parachute, and it was decided that people should be given experience of a drop. This was done by a flight operating from Henlo, and they had a Vickers Beamy wartime aircraft. And the way it was done was as follows. That little stand was built round the bottom of the interplane strut on the bottom wing, and you took off with your parachute strapped to your back. You took off facing, touching the strut, facing the rear, and one of you on one side and another on the other side to balance the aircraft. The one on the other side, in my case, was a man called Chick, who was a very famous rugby player and weighed a good deal more than I did. You climbed to about 2,000 feet, and the pilot then put his arm up, and you turned round on a little platform at the bottom of the strut, still touching the strut, and then on a signal from him, you pulled the ring of your parachute, and you were pulled off the aeroplane, whether you liked it or not, and that was that. Johnny Chick and I both descended together, but as he weighed about 4 stone more than I did, he hit the ground much earlier than I did. He damaged his ankle and was not able to play rugby for some time, but I, being very light, was not damaged in any way. From then on, we used parachutes in all the flights that were made. In October 1929, I was posted from Farnborough to the Marine Aircraft Establishment, Experimental Establishment at Felixstowe, as adjutant. I took every opportunity of flying the various types of float planes that were available at that time, and so did not lose touch with practical flying. The high-speed flight of 1929
came back from Calcutta two weeks ago, and the CEO of the 1929 high-speed flight, Squadron Leader Olivar, was in charge of all flying at Felixstowe. When I saw these aircraft, I felt that if possible, I would do my utmost to be enabled to fly them. So I asked my commanding officer, who was Group Captain Geoffrey Bromett, whether he would agree to my doing so. And much to my surprise, he said, yes, I could do so. So I was enabled to fly what high-speed aircraft were then in the flight, which consisted of the Gloucester 4 racing biplane, the Supermarine S5, and the Supermarine S6. I put in a number of flights on these different aircraft and found it extremely interesting and rewarding.
My duties as adjutant at Felixstowe consisted of mostly routine organization and the dealing with airmen who had committed various misdemeanors, and helping my commanding officer with the administration of the station. But I was mainly interested in flying these various high-speed aircraft. The question was, of course, this was in the end of 29 and during 1930, and the question was, of course, was there going to be another Schneider Trophy in 1931? Perhaps it would be appropriate at this time just briefly to mention the history of the Schneider Trophy contest. In 1912, Monsieur Jacques Schneider, who was a Frenchman, gave a trophy which consists of, in silver, which consists of, I presume, a figure of Aphrodite kissing the waves. The first contest for this trophy, and it was given for the advancement of long-distance maritime aviation. The first contest was held in 1913 and was won by a Frenchman, Monsieur Maurice Prévost, who won the contest at the staggering speed of 45 miles an hour. The reason that the speed was so low was that he had not crossed the finishing line whilst airborne, but had crossed it on the water. So he was sent off again to cross it properly in flight, and this time was counted against him. In 1914, it was won by the British aircraft flown by a man called Howard Pixton, and he won it in a Sopwith tabloid float plane at a speed of some 80-odd miles an hour. The contests were held every year, and were held at the in the country which had previously won the contest. The contest was won by Great Britain in 1914. It was won again by Great Britain in 1922, in 1927, in 1929, and in 1931. It was won by the United States of America 1923 and 1925. From 1925 onwards, it was decided that once a year was too frequent and that the contest would be held every 2 years. The United States had won it, as I say, in 1923 and 1925. And they had their pilots were serving officers. The first one was won by Lieutenant Rittenhouse, and the second time in 1925 it was won by another American lieutenant, as he was then, Jimmy Doolittle, who became, of course, famous during the war as General Doolittle, and he led the raid from aircraft carrier onto Tokyo. As I say, it was then decided to run it every 2 years, and the last country to win it was France, and so it was held, I beg your pardon, the last country to win it was Italy, and so it was held in 1927 at Venice, and it was won by Flight Lieutenant Webster flying a submarine S5. In 1929, it was won by Great Britain, and the contest was held at Calshot, and it was won by Great Britain in the shape of Flight Lieutenant Waghorn flying a submarine S6. It then had to be decided whether we would partake in the 1931 contest. The Labour government at the time refused to have anything to do with it or to put up any money to enable it to be possible. But fortunately, a certain Lady Houston, who was a very rich woman, came to our rescue and gave £100,000 to the Royal Aero Club to enable the contest to be held in 1931. Unfortunately, of course, as the contest had to be held in September and the decision to partake was not taken because we had no money until May of that year, in the short time available, it was impossible to design new aircraft for it. So all that could be done was to improve as far as possible on the 1929 S6 aircraft and improve on the Rolls-Royce engine and do the best we could. I was then incorporated into the high-speed flight, which again was commanded by Squadron Leader Orlebar, and we moved from Felixstowe to Calshot in May of 1931. We had as practice aircraft the Gloucester 4 racing biplane, the submarine S5, which had won the 1927 contest, and the S6s, which had won the 1929 contest. It might be appropriate now to say something about these aircraft. The Gloucester 4 was a small biplane powered by a racing Napalm engine. It was straightforward to take off and fly, and was a very good practice aircraft. The submarine S5 also had It was a low-wing monoplane, wire-braced. It also had an Epilan engine of some 900 horsepower. The S-6 was a very different kettle of fish. It was a much larger and heavier aircraft than the S-5. It was powered by a special Rolls-Royce racing engine, which was called the R engine, R for racing, and developed 1,900 horsepower. It was an aircraft that was somewhat difficult to get off the water because of the enormous torque of the propeller. It was before the days, of course, of variable pitch propellers, and it was before the days of wing flaps, which enabled you to become airborne more quickly. And the only way to get it off the water was to point the nose at some 45 degrees out of the wind, so that by the time the aircraft had swung into wind, you had sufficient rudder control to keep it straight. I held the unenviable record at Felixstowe of having the longest takeoff ever recorded on the S6, which was some 86 seconds, which I don't know exactly what would be presumably about 2 miles. Well, we moved to Calshot, as I say, in May of 1931, and that great designer, Mitchell, set about doing what he could to improve the performance of the S6 and produced what was called the S6B. This had longer floats than the S6, and Rolls-Royce had developed the engine so that it gave us 450 horsepower more than it did in 1929. In other words, the horsepower went up from 1900 to 2350. It was the aircraft was slightly easier to take off because of the increased power, but a great problem was presented in cooling this extra power. All the wings were covered in inbuilt radiator. There were radiators on the top of the floats, and every spare part of the aircraft that could be used as radiators was in fact so used. But the power of the engine was such that the radiator surface proved insufficient, and therefore if you kept the engine at full throttle, the engine would boil. So all we could do, and what we had to do, was to run throttle down slightly and run on your water temperature gauge and not allow it to exceed 90 degrees centigrade. We did a lot of practice at Felixstowe. The original S6s were modernized, fitted with the higher powered engine, and were known as the S6A. The personnel of the flight were as follows. Squadron Leader Orlebar was the commander, and he did all the first flights on all the aircraft, and was a magnificent commander and a magnificent pilot. The other members of the flight were Flight Lieutenant Stainforth, who had been in the 1929 team, Flight Lieutenant Hope, who was new to it, Flight Lieutenant Boothman, Flying Officer Snaith, and myself. We practiced the got in as much practice as ever we could, but we had some bad luck. For example, Flight Lieutenant Hope, in landing one day, hit the wash of a ship and capsized and sank, but managed to get out and surface. But unfortunately, he had broken one of his eardrums, and therefore was unable to continue flying. His place was taken by a Royal Naval officer of the Fleet Air Arm, Lieutenant Brinton, Royal Navy. And we did all we could to... He hadn't flown any of these aircraft before, but we did as much as we could to give him time in the air, but it was a very bad summer, and so it was rather difficult to get in as much time as one would like to. The next thing that happened was that one of the modified S-6s, the S-6A, was delivered, and Squadron Leader Orlebar did the first flight on it. We were standing at Calshot Castle, watching him come overhead at full out speed, when to our horror we saw that his tail was oscillating violently. He pulled the throttle fully shut, and the oscillation eventually died out, and he was able to land right out in the middle of the Solent. It was found on examination that this was due to rudder flutter, and the aircraft had to be modified, and the rivets had sheared at the end of the fuselage, and so the aircraft had to be extensively modified to cope with this, and mass balances were fitted to the rudder, and also for good measure and also for good measure to the ailerons. When the aircraft was delivered back after these modifications, it proved perfectly satisfactory. There was always trouble with the propeller efficiency. As I say, there were no variable pitch propellers, and therefore you had to absorb this huge amount of horsepower with a fixed pitch prop, which was all right at high speed, but of course set up the most tremendous torque in taking off. The port float would dig into the water, and therefore you carried 90 gallons of fuel in the starboard float and 30 gallons of fuel in the port float in order to counterbalance this tendency. This was successful to some extent, but by no means cured the problem, and therefore many different types of propellers were tried until they were incidentally made by of a solid piece of aluminium, or duralumin rather, by Fairey Reed, and eventually we got the best compromise that we could. Just to show you what the propeller had to do, when you ran up your engine before taking off, your maximum revs were 1,800, whereas your maximum revs in level flight were 3,000. And therefore that gives you some idea of the difficulties with the propeller design and compromise. There was one other characteristic of these aircraft which made them difficult in some ways to get off the water, and that was that you had to hold the stick back as far as it would go during the whole of the takeoff run, and if the aircraft started to porpoise, which quite often did, then you had to shut the throttle right down and start again. You eventually became airborne still with the stick right back as far as it would go, and you had to keep it there until you were actually starting to climb properly in the air. This was contrary to all the instincts of a normal pilot, and it was something that you had to get used to. Lieutenant Brinson did his first flight on the S-6A, and he started to porpoise slightly, but instead of shutting down his engine, he kept it full open, and the porpoising got worse, and eventually the aircraft bounced off the water, and we think he must have let the stick go forward a little bit instead of holding it back in his stomach, because the aircraft hit the water with a resounding crash and sank, and Brinton was killed. In fact, he broke his neck. So we were short of one pilot. It was then a question of whether the other contending countries were going to show up. France had was having a lot of trouble and had no intention of competing. The Americans did not send a team, and the Italians were having great trouble with their aircraft. They had killed, I think, two of their pilots, and their engine were giving a lot of technical troubles, and so they decided very reluctantly that they had to withdraw. We then had to, this country then had to take the decision whether to scrap the whole thing or whether to go ahead without the other countries, and if we completed the course, it would be, so to speak, a walkover. And if you won the trophy three times running, which it would be in this case, the trophy would remain in that this country would retain the trophy in perpetuity. It was decided that we would do this. There was no question of the of each of us trying to contend with the others as to who was going to fly around the course faster than anybody else. And it was agreed as follows, that George Stainforth would go for the speed record because he was the senior. John Boozman would fly over the course and on one of the new S6Bs. If he failed to complete the course or was disqualified in any way, the idea then was that Flying Officer Snaith on the S6A should fly around the course to make sure of completing it no matter how slowly, and that then I, flying the second new machine, S1596, would try and beat the record for the course. As it turned out, Boozman successfully completed the course, and therefore it was unnecessary for Snaith or myself to take any part. I can assure you that both of us took this in good measure, but it would be untrue to say that we weren't bitterly disappointed. Some few days after that, I beg your pardon, the same day, George Stainforth had a go at the record and did in fact succeed in improving on the present record. But he felt that he could do better than this, and so about a fortnight later, he had another go, and he put the speed record up to 407 miles an hour. He had had an accident beforehand with the other S6B in taking off, he used full rudder, and his the heel of his shoe caught behind the rudder slide, and he couldn't release it in time, and the aircraft capsized and sank. He was not hurt in any way at all, but was most concerned because a new watch that he'd been given was ruined by salt water. As I say, he then, on the other S6B, won the world speed record at 407 miles an hour.
Was that over a straight course, or...?
The course was triangular, and it was as follows. The start and finish was at Ryde Pier in the Isle of Wight, and then to a pylon on a destroyer between the Isle of Wight and the mainland, and then across to West Wittring on the Sussex coast, and then along the coast past Portsmouth and Southsea to another pylon, which was on another destroyer in the Solent, and then to Ryde Pier again. There were seven laps, each lap